From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, reservations about the Bush administration's push toward war expressed by intelligence professionals, military officers, and diplomats. We talk with Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He co-wrote an article reporting these misgivings. We'll also talk about the new CIA letter saying that Saddam Hussein would be more likely to adapt terrorist actions if he believed a U.S. attack could no longer be deterred. Also, we look at the war against terrorism with Daniel Benjamin, who served in the Clinton administration as the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism. He's the co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House and Senate continued debate today on a resolution authorizing military action against Iraq. Representative Jay Inslee, a Washington Democrat, supports an alternative resolution that calls for the U.S. to build international support before using force against Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein.
We do owe our soldiers and our Marines, our sons and our daughters, every effort to try every means before war. And it is clear that we have not yet exhausted all of our options before opening the door to war.
On the Senate side, Senator Olympia Snowe supports giving the president the authority he wants. And the Republican from Maine says the U.S. and the international community have to stand up to the Iraqi regime.
If we allow the Iraqi regime to continue developing its horrific capabilities with impunity, we are endangering mankind by sending a corrosive message that the stockpiling of weapons of mass destruction buys immunity from international response.
Meanwhile, anti-war protesters gathered outside the Capitol building. NPR's Andrea Seabrook was on the scene.
While they're debating resolution giving the president power to have action against Iraq on the inside of the Capitol, out here they're now arresting protesters who are blocking the entrance into the Capitol building. They see it as their last chance here to protest this resolution. Some of the signs say, change the resolution. I don't want to go to war. Work with the United Nations. No war for oil. Just say no. All sorts of slogans that are against the resolution.
The House is expected to vote on the measure tomorrow, and the administration is predicting overwhelming approval. The Senate has not yet scheduled a vote on the resolution. U.S. military officials say there's been another shooting incident involving American soldiers in Kuwait. News agencies are quoting unnamed U.S. officials as saying a U.S. soldier fired a shot at a civilian car in Kuwait after he believed he saw a person in the car pointing a gun at him. It wasn't clear from initial reports whether anyone was wounded in the shooting. U.S. troops in Kuwait have been on alert since yesterday when two Kuwaiti men attacked U.S. Marines, killing one and wounding another before they were killed. Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 215 points, or nearly 3%. It closed at 7,286 in heavy trading of 1.8 billion shares. Declining issues led advances by 6-1. The Nasdaq Composite Index lost 15 points, or 1.3%. It closed at 1,114. The S&P 500 lost 22 points, 2.7%, to close at 776. This is NPR News. Ports on the West Coast are set to open up in a few hours. President Bush got a court order yesterday that ended the lockout and cleared the way for members of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union to return to work. But as NPR's Ina Jaffe reports, it'll take some time for things to return to normal.
According to the Pacific Maritime Association, which represents the shipping companies, it could take as long as 10 weeks to deal with the aftermath of a 10-day lockout. It's more complicated to fix something than to break it, explained a spokesman. There are more than 200 ships anchored outside of West Coast ports. At most locations, returning dock workers will move perishable goods first. The Pacific Maritime Association, or PMA, has been in contentious contract negotiations with the Longshore Workers Union for 5 months. The PMA accused the workers of staging a slowdown and locked them out. The union denies there was a slowdown and insists that workers were just being scrupulous about safety regulations. 5 dock workers have been killed in accidents at West Coast ports in the past few months. Ina Jaffe, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Senate Democrats called today for the resignation of the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, saying that Harvey Pitt is under the influence of the accounting industry. The controversy centers on Pitt's choice to head a new board created to oversee accounting companies. Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt said Pitt withdrew support from a candidate to head the board because accounting firms opposed him. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer accused the Democrats of playing politics. He said there was no merit to the charge that Pitt was too close to the companies that he's supposed to regulate. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of natural vitamin E, ADM, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, a letter was released from the CIA warning that a U.S. attack against Iraq could make it more likely that Saddam Hussein would adapt terrorist methods, such as the use of chemical or biological weapons. This letter is in sync with private doubts about the Bush administration's rush to war, expressed by some military officers, intelligence professionals, and diplomats. Those reservations were reported in an article yesterday co-written by my guest Jonathan Landay. He's the national security correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers, including the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Miami Herald, and the Detroit Free Press. Landay's article is based on interviews with dissenting officials who work in a number of different agencies. They did not want their names used out of fear of retribution. Before we talk about their reservations, let's start with a summary of the letter from the CIA, which was addressed to the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Bob Graham.
Essentially, the letter from the CIA, which was written by the deputy director, John McLaughlin, but on behalf of the director, George Tenet, says that the CIA believes that for now, Baghdad is drawing a line short of conducting terrorist attacks against the United States without a conventional, chemical, or biological weapons. In essence, what this letter says is there is no immediate threat, in the CIA's judgment, that Saddam Hussein is going to use chemical or biological weapons against the United States. However, a very interesting part of the letter talks about how if the United States prepares for an attack against Iraq, and should Saddam Hussein conclude that this attack is going to be forthcoming, he might no longer be deterred from using such weapons against the United States, and could even decide at that point to turn biological chemical weapons over to terrorists.
So the assumption there is that the CIA doesn't think he's already turned any of those weapons over to Islamic terrorists.
Exactly. And in fact, even before the CIA letter came out, I heard from somebody by email yesterday saying exactly that, someone who's in the academic community but maintains very close connections with people in both the intelligence community and the Department of Defense. And he was saying to me that this is a scenario that people are extremely concerned about, the fact that there may not be a threat right now, but if Saddam finds himself cornered with nothing left to lose, then it would be in his interest to provide these weapons to terrorists for use in revenge attacks against the United States.
Now, the letter also says that al-Qaeda leaders sought contacts in Iraq who could help them acquire weapons of mass destruction, and that Iraq has provided members of al-Qaeda with training in the areas of poison gases and bomb making. So how much of a connection is that between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein?
Well, it's very hard to judge given the fact that a lot of this is classified, and the administration has been unwilling to go very far in describing the sources of this information. However, in a recent story that we have written, we have reported that this information, according to our sources, is coming from Abu Zubaydah, who was a senior al-Qaeda operative arrested in Pakistan earlier this year. The thing is that some intelligence analysts are questioning the veracity of Mr. Zubaydah's disclosures because, as they note, it would be in al-Qaeda's interest for the United States to believe that there was a connection because that would feed drive towards a war. That would be a major recruiting tool for al-Qaeda, given the fact that it would, in the minds of many Muslims, confirm a view that the United States policy is one of being anti-Muslim.
Let's look at this information in the context of the article that you wrote yesterday, saying that a lot of people in the military, intelligence, and diplomatic communities have a lot of reservations about the Bush administration's double-time march toward war, and that the Bush administration has been exaggerating evidence of the threat that Saddam Hussein poses, including distorting his links to the al-Qaeda network. In what way did your sources tell you they think the Bush administration has been distorting evidence of the links between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda?
Well, to begin with, people we've talked to agree that there may or have been senior al-Qaeda operatives in Baghdad, but they also point out that there are more senior al-Qaeda operatives in places like Riyadh, Karachi, Paris, London, even the United States, and that in and of itself does not prove a link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda in terms of a plot to stage anti-American terrorist attacks. So that is one of the first things that people have pointed out to us. Secondly, it is our understanding from sources that some of the evidence that has been used to make this charge that senior al-Qaeda have been in Baghdad is telephone monitoring of calls made by a senior al-Qaeda official from Baghdad, but to members of his family and friends, and that there is no evidence from that call of any kind of link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein in terms of terrorist operations.
No, your sources have told you anonymously that they think the Bush administration is filtering information from the intelligence and military community, that the Bush administration is basically only using information that backs up its case in preparing for war. Can you give us an example or two of that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, that the CIA letter tends to substantiate what we were being told, in that the CIA director says, in other words, that they do not see this imminent threat from Saddam Hussein that the administration publicly has been talking about. But beyond that, there are other things that have been brought to our attention. For instance, another public disclosure last week and another CIA report talked about Iraq's attempts to import thousands of high-strength aluminum tubes. And this report points out that while a majority of analysts in the intelligence community believe that these tubes were destined for Iraq's nuclear weapons program, others within that same community disagree and say that these tubes were in fact destined for conventional weapons. The tubes have an anodized exterior, which makes them very smooth and in the opinion of some analysts, extremely useful for making ground-to-ground rockets, not for making high-speed centrifuges that are used in the production of enriched uranium. Now, despite the fact that there is this dispute going on within the analyst community, President Bush has twice, first before the United Nations and then earlier this week in his televised speech to the nation, said categorically that these tubes are destined for use in Iraq's nuclear program. And so, obviously, it's the president's right to decide which view within the intelligence community he's going to adopt. The fact is that he made this categorical statement despite the fact that there is, in fact, this dispute going on as to what the purpose of these tubes is or was.
This is just speculation. But do you have any idea why the CIA decided to make public the information that they did yesterday?
Yeah, it's conjecture, but it seems to me that the CIA's charter or its purpose is to provide a balanced, even-handed analysis of intelligence to what they refer to as consumers. Those are officials within the United States government, the policy-making branches of the United States government, who use that intelligence to try to make informed decisions on policy. And if you think about it, the fact that the CIA has gone public with some of this stuff seems, at least in my mind and the minds of other people that I've talked to indicate that the CIA believes that this stuff needs to be out there because perhaps there hasn't been even-handed use and dissemination of intelligence, and they want to make sure that there is.
My guest is Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. He co-wrote an article published yesterday reporting that many military officers, intelligence professionals, and diplomats have serious reservations about the Bush administration's rush toward war. Now, intelligence professionals within the administration who are critical of the administration's position on Iraq also told you that they think the Bush administration is downplaying the potential repercussions of a new war in the Gulf. What are some of their concerns?
Well, senior diplomats are extremely concerned about the impact that an invasion, U.S. invasion of Iraq would have on stability in the region around Iraq. One concern is the impact on Iran. Now, Iran is in the midst of a power struggle between hardline elements and reformists. The fear is that a U.S. invasion would be used by the hardliners as an excuse to accelerate their crackdown on the reformists in Iran. Don't forget now that if there's a U.S. invasion of Iraq, there would then be U.S. troops on two of Iran's borders, Afghanistan and Iraq, that not only would the hardliners use this so-called threat of the United States to accelerate their crackdown on reformers, but could use it to accelerate Iran's own weapons of mass destruction programs. So that's one of the major concerns. Another concern is a serious concern is the impact that an invasion of Iraq would have on the situation between India and Pakistan. Indian officials in recent days have been talking about, in favorable terms, about the Bush administration's new preemptive prevention strategy. And why not, if it's good enough for the United States, why wouldn't it be good enough for India in its dispute with Pakistan over the Kashmir region? The bases of Islamic militants who are fighting in the Indian side of Kashmir are located in Pakistan, and there have been Indian officials could use a preemptive prevention strategy to hit at those bases while the United States was engaged in Iraq. Such an incident could be the spark to a war that has been threatening to break out between India and Pakistan for nearly a year now. The president of Pakistan, General Pervez Musharraf, has threatened repeatedly that if India was to do such a thing as hit at the militant bases in Pakistan, he would strike back, and he has said that that Pakistan's counterattack would not be confined to the Kashmir region. And so you have the potential of a new war between India and Pakistan, both of which are armed with nuclear weapons.
Now, something else you've been hearing from the military, intelligence, and diplomatic communities, and that is that the Bush administration is squelching dissenting views. What are some of the specific claims that have been made?
Well, essentially what we're hearing is not so much that there are dissenting claims, but that there's no evidence really that has been forthcoming that shows that the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction programs are any more advanced or any more threatening than they were before at the end of the Gulf War. The Iraqis had been involved in trying to develop nuclear weapons since the 1980s, and their major problem was coming up with the fuel for a nuclear weapon, either making it themselves or finding it somewhere else. Well, there's no indication that they have been any more successful in that endeavor than they have been over the past decade. They had come very close to developing many of the systems that drive a nuclear weapon, both the conventional explosives, and actually had a weapon design, two weapons designs. But again, were unable to make or find the fissile material that's necessary to drive a weapon. That is still seems to be the case. Even the president admits that when he says that if they were able to find fissile material, it would take them only a year to make a bomb. The fact is, though, that in the most recent CIA report, the CIA states that, but the CIA also states that if they can't get fissile material, it's unlikely that they would be able to build a bomb before the end of this decade, and the last half of this decade. And therefore, there's a note there that's a lot less urgent than what we're hearing from many administration officials.
Intelligence analysts told you that they think they're under pressure to produce reports that support the White House's arguments.
We're hearing that from not only from intelligence types, but also from military and diplomatic officials, that there is a great deal of pressure to produce intelligence analyses that support the administration's agenda. I can't give you specific. We did not come up with any specific examples of this, but this is something that we're hearing from quite a few sources.
Now, I'm wondering if the people who are telling you this anonymously found you, whether they were so anxious to let the public know about this that they found you, or whether you've been calling out and asking them.
In fact, it began with some unsolicited contacts from within the intelligence and military communities, and that's what convinced us to go out and try and see if this was how widespread this feeling was. We can't quantify how widespread it is. You know, there was no statistical data. We didn't do a public opinion survey within the government. Nevertheless, the fact is that we heard consistently from everybody we've heard, and I've heard since the piece appeared from several other people, that this is indeed the case.
What message do you think these people with dissenting views would like to give the American public?
I think the message is that there needs to be a wider spectrum of data presented. That and you hear this also. It's not just from these people. I mean, you listen to some of the lawmakers coming out of their classified briefings on the Hill about all of this, and they're saying exactly the same things, that they haven't heard anything new, that they haven't heard anything that indicates that there's an imminent threat, and that they're far more concerned about the impact of a U.S. invasion on regional stability, as well as, they want to know, what about the day after and the day after that? What happens to Iraq under an American occupation?
Tom Ricks from the Washington Post said on our show a couple of months ago that he had found that the military was particularly cautious about going to war against Iraq because they were afraid of what the consequences might be. Did you find that your sources in the military are concerned about what their people, what their men and women will face if we go to war now with Iraq?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's definitely part of what some of the misgivings are, that there are some fairly scary scenarios out there. However, I don't think that there's anybody we've talked to who would say that the United States military couldn't prevail in an invasion of Iraq. I think what the greatest concerns are, as I said, the day after and the impact that such an invasion would have, not only on regional stability, but on the prosecution of the war on terrorism. There's a great deal of apprehension about that, and not about overstretch, but, for instance, about the possibility that countries that are opposed to an American invasion of Iraq could tighten the taps on intelligence sharing, intelligence that's crucial to the U.S. effort to track down al-Qaeda. The other concern, a very big concern, is the fact that an Iraq invasion could be one of the best recruiting tools that al-Qaeda has had in a long time, particularly if there are high civilian casualties and large-scale destruction as a result of urban fighting. That is especially worrisome to people that we've talked to.
So the people in the intelligence, military, and diplomatic communities who are expressing their skepticism about the evidence that the Bush administration is using in support of war with Iraq, are these skeptics saying, therefore, we should not go to war with Iraq, or therefore, we shouldn't go as quickly?
I think that's the case. I think they believe there needs to be far more consideration given to what's going on, and consideration of the widest possible spectrum of potential outcomes, rather than this, what they believe is this attitude of we can do this, and you know, we don't want to hear any bad news.
Well, Jonathan Landy, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jonathan Landy is national security correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By Crown Publishing, a division of Random House Incorporated, publishers of If I Live to Be 100, Lessons from the Centurions by Nina Ellis, producer of NPR's 100 Years of Stories. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Columbus in the Americas by author William Least Heat Moon, now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the war against terrorism as seen by a former insider. We talk with Daniel Benjamin, director of counterterrorism for the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's co-authored a new book called The Age of Sacred Terror. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Daniel Benjamin, was helping to mobilize the fight against terrorism before most Americans realized the magnitude of the terrorist threat. Benjamin was the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism from 1998 to 1999 under President Clinton. From 1994 to 1997, he was President Clinton's Special Assistant and Foreign Policy Speechwriter. Before entering the administration, he was the Wall Street Journal's Berlin bureau chief and a foreign correspondent for Time. Benjamin is the co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. It's both a history of Islamist terror and a behind-the-scenes account of counter-terrorist actions during the Clinton administration. I asked Benjamin if he was convinced by President Bush's speech last week, making the case that we need to go to war if Saddam Hussein doesn't quickly disarm.
I'm not sure the president's presentation made any difference to my thinking, although I think it was the most effective speech he's given yet on the issue. I'm in the same place that I was before, which is to say that I think that we are likely to have to go to war with Saddam Hussein at some point in the future. I'm not fully confident yet that the administration has understood the distinction between jihadist terrorists like Osama bin Laden and his followers and a state sponsor of terror like Saddam Hussein.
What are some of the important distinctions you think need to be made?
Well, Saddam Hussein is not an entirely rational person and certainly not a predictable one, but certain facts are going to govern his calculations. And chief among them is that he wants to hold on to his country. And he knows that doing some things will make that absolutely impossible, one of them being giving a weapon of mass destruction to a terrorist group. By contrast, we know that that Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda, what's left of it, or its successor group, and I'm sure there will be one, would not hesitate to use such a weapon against the United States and would probably use it almost as fast as it could get it and design a conspiracy. Well, and I think that these are two very different phenomena.
Daniel Benjamin, you were the director of counterterrorism for the National Security Council under the Clinton administration from 1998 to 1999. What was the wake-up call for the Clinton administration about terrorism?
Well, I think the wake-up call, or the watershed for us, was the bombing of the embassies in East Africa. There had been an awful lot of concern for a number of years about the rising threat of Islamist terror, but the bombings in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam had a catalytic effect because they showed that these terrorists were prepared to kill in a way that previous terrorists had not. Now, the actual number of dead in the two bombings was roughly the same with such attacks as the bombing of the Beirut barracks, the bombing of Pan Am 103. But what was particularly noteworthy was that the terrorists were prepared to kill an awful lot of Africans, including many, many African Muslims, to kill a few Americans. And that was unusual. And also that they were prepared to have so many potential sympathizers injured, grievously wounded. There were something like 5,000 people wounded in the two bombings. And this was a real departure from what we had seen before, because traditionally terrorists have sought to create a sense of theater, a theater of fear, and they wanted to have a few casualties and an awful lot of attention. And here it was clear that the violence itself was the goal. And that was really for us the wake-up call. I should add that it was a case of the alarm going off twice. Just weeks before, we had received intelligence that Al-Qaeda was seeking to procure chemical weapons in Sudan. And so once the bombings were carried out in East Africa and we had a sense of what kind of violence they were prepared to carry out, and we had this information about the chemical weapons as well, we realized that this was not a group that we could count on to calibrate its violence as terrorist organizations had in the past.
Not long after the embassy bombings in Africa, the United States bombed a plant in Khartoum in Sudan that it said was making chemical weapons. What was the thinking behind that attack?
As I mentioned, we had this information that bin Laden was working with the National Islamic Front government of Sudan to procure chemical weapons. And the feeling was that anyone who was who was prepared to do what al-Qaeda had done in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam would not hesitate to go one step further and, in fact, break an almost unbroken taboo. Aum Shinrikyo had used a chemical weapon in Tokyo a few years earlier, but by and large, that we believe that that taboo still held. But now it was clear that there was someone who was prepared to kill on the grand scale and was prepared to use taboo weapons to do so. And as a result, it seemed like not only the wise, but the minimal responsible thing to do to attack the plant in Khartoum. Now, I should just qualify what you said by noting that the intelligence did not demonstrate that chemical weapons were being made there, but rather that the place was in some way associated with chemical weapons. The precursor to the nerve gas, VX, was found right by the by this chemical plant. And in retrospect, that leaves us uncertain as to whether or not it was being made there or transshipped there or stored there before it was actually weaponized. But the fact that we had fairly conclusive indications that that there was chemical weapons activity and that al-Qaeda was involved, we know that bin Laden had invested in this effort, made it seem like, made it clear that it was really the right thing to do.
When the Clinton administration ordered the bombing in Sudan, thinking that there was some involvement there with chemical weapons, President Clinton was accused by his critics of wagging the dog because the bombing was 3 days after his testimony before the grand jury about Monica Lewinsky. And his critics were saying, well, sure, he's bombing. It's just a way of distracting from this horrible sex scandal that he's involved with. You were working for the National Security Council in counterterrorism at the time. What was your reaction when you were hearing all these wag-the-dog accusations?
Everyone was clear before the missiles were launched, before the cruise missiles were launched, that there would be some of this, that there would be some argument of wag-the-dog. And, in fact, Secretary of Defense Cohen brought it up in the principals committee meeting where they decided to approve the attack, and the president himself knew that he would encounter some criticism. Nonetheless, you know, this is a group of people, and the president in particular, who were charged with national security, and they felt that this was their responsibility. They had to take the flak, really, for the good of the country. I think we were all stunned by how far it went. The lack of belief that the administration might be telling the truth, that the intelligence community might have actually gotten it right, that the soil sample that was collected at the Al Shifa plant might actually show this, the presence of this precursor, was really remarkable to me and many of my colleagues. And I guess we all felt it was just a low point for trust in government, for people thinking about, you know, the threats we face. There's no question that that impeachment had become the vortex in American life, and everything else was swept into it.
During this impeachment era, when you were working on counterterrorism and some of the counterterrorism aspects were accused of being wag the dog, who were you more frustrated with, the president for having gotten himself into the predicament that made these accusations even possible, or the people who were going after him? Were you more frustrated with them for not kind of being able to distinguish his personal problems from the real problems of international terrorism?
I think everyone who was working in the White House at that time was deeply disappointed by the president's behavior and by the situation that we were in, where we were working extremely hard to carry out what we thought were good policies, and we were undermined by the distraction. At the same time, you know, I was working for that president. I didn't resign because I continued to think that the policies were right, and I continued to think that his enemies were more wrong than he was, and that, in fact, I felt the president could be faulted for giving his enemies an opening, but I think that they deserve a lot of criticism for taking the country away from serious issues and for not having any sense of balance, not having any sense of the proper proportion of these different issues.
My guest is Daniel Benjamin, co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Benjamin, author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. We're talking about anti-terrorism efforts during the Clinton administration. Benjamin was the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism from 1998 to 1999 during the Clinton administration. You cite several instances where pettiness or infighting or a misguided approach to saving money stood in the way of really dealing a blow to terrorists. Give us one of the examples that you feel is particularly compelling.
Well, this was a period in which I think a group of us in the White House and a group of people in CIA and a sprinkling of people in other agencies recognized that there was a new kind of threat. But we were faced by two problems. One was that when you have a major change in the nature of your security environment, when you have a major change in the nature of the threat, people are invested in not seeing what's new. The bureaucracy doesn't like to change. That's just the nature of large organizations. And what's more is the permanent government is not so eager to get pushed around by the elected government, the government that changes every 4 years. And so we saw, you know, any number of cases where the message really hadn't gotten out. We saw at the State Department, for example, after the embassy bombings, we in the White House literally ordered them to dispatch medicines and vaccines and biochem suits, you know, the very bulky suits that you would wear in a unconventional attack, and other equipment for washing down people who had been people and equipment that had been contaminated, and they just refused to do it. We tried this again and again, and they kept changing the office director, the interlocutor in the State Department who was supposed to deal with it. And finally, after a year of banging our heads on this, we just gave up. You know, we couldn't move the department. The department was also reluctant to take a lot of the money that was being offered to it by the White House, by the by OMB, to build new and safer embassies. And when OMB, which exists to deny funding to agencies, put hundreds of millions of dollars in the State Department's budget proposal, it got looted for programmatic purposes, so that, you know, we could have any number of different kinds of activities going on at different embassies. And it took a big showdown at the White House to get that money restored to the budget.
After being so involved with counterterrorism, what's it like for you to now watch from the sidelines as we seem to be approaching war with Iraq and as we're kind of worried about what the next terrorist attack is going to be?
My biggest concern is that this paradigm shift, as we call it, this change of in the nature of terrorism really hasn't been absorbed by the country and quite possibly also some of its leaders, because this is really an enduring phenomenon and just profoundly dangerous. When people feel that their killing is divinely sanctioned, it's divinely justified, and that they don't much care about the immediate reaction, whether they themselves are going to die in a suicide attack, then you're dealing with an undeterrable threat. And I don't think people have fully recognized how deeply rooted that is in a region and how much that phenomenon is strengthening in a part of the world that really stretches from Algeria to Indonesia. And I feel that our foreign policy priorities haven't taken that into account yet. I think if we had, we'd be working very hard to try and change the conditions in those countries that breed this ideology, and also to recognize that what goes on in those countries is as dangerous as what goes on between them.
Now, in your book, you write that you have evidence that Hamas, an Islamic fundamentalist group that has attacked Israel, is working now with al-Qaeda. What evidence is there that you could discuss?
Well, there have been several cases of individuals, and we know this because they've been arrested, having contact with both organizations and carrying on, you know, conspiratorial activities. One of them was Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, who was really dispatched by al-Qaeda to go and establish contacts with Hamas, and he was doing surveillance work in Israel sometime before he was caught on that plane trying to ignite the bomb in his shoe. There was another one named, I believe, Okal, who was picked up, I think, in Turkey. This is an extremely worrisome situation because Hamas shares a lot of the ideas of al-Qaeda. If you look at their charter and if you look at their long-term ideology of being part of a new caliphate that embraces all of the Islamic community. But their behavior has been more calibrated. It's been more old-style terrorism. And if Hamas were indeed to turn into an al-Qaeda-like group, then the situation in the Middle East could become much worse.
Well, you also say that Hamas may target the United States in the future. What motivation would they have for doing that?
Jihadist terrorists believe that the United States and Israel are the far enemy, that there is a war being waged against all of Islam, that sometimes they differ as to who's pulling the strings, but usually these days the United States gets the lion's share of the guilt. And the great innovation of bin Laden and al-Qaeda was that they decided that instead of going after the near enemy, instead of attacking the secular rulers in the Islamic world and trying to bring about a revolution at the national level, they went to the international level. And the idea was that if you could convince the United States to withdraw its support for these regimes, then they would have no way of defending themselves. That's really one of the key things about al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda believes that to do that, to change America's mind, to force it to withdraw, requires an enormous amount of violence. So it's entirely possible that if Hamas becomes frustrated with its fight at the national level, it too could leap to the international level and fight in the same way as al-Qaeda and attack Americans.
What do you think the odds of that happening are?
It's very difficult to say. So much depends on what else happens in the territories and with Israel. If, in fact, a new generation of leaders does come to the fore very soon in the Palestinian Authority, then it's entirely possible that they would see the need to go after Hamas in a really vigorous way. The Palestinian Authority has always had the ability to shut down Hamas in the past. That ability may be somewhat eroded now, but a lot will really depend on what the PA looks like in the months ahead.
My guest is Daniel Benjamin, author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Daniel Benjamin, author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. He was the National Security Council's Director of Counterterrorism from 1998 to 99 during the Clinton administration. Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, there's something essentially goofy looking about him, and he didn't do a very effective job, thank God, of setting his bomb off, the bomb in his shoe. And, you write in your book that the foiled plot to bomb New York landmarks, that some of the people behind that seem pretty inept. And the impression I get is that you think the FBI found it a little easier than they should have to dismiss terrorist threats because they thought of a lot of these guys as being goofy and inept.
That was certainly true in the early 90s. I think the two key facts that persuaded the FBI that it didn't have too much to worry about were the fact that the man who rented the van, the Ryder van that was used to blow up the bomb underneath the World Trade Center the first time around, went back to the rental agency and tried to get his deposit back, tried, in fact, three or four times. So this convinced the Bureau, I think, that they were dealing with some morons. The next case, the Day of Terror, in which the commuter tunnels and 26 Federal Plaza, which is the FBI headquarters, and the UN were to be targeted, was a conspiracy that only progressed because there was an FBI informant in the group who was telling them how to build bombs and do basic terrorist activities. So there again, I think they felt like they'd wrapped up a bunch of incompetence. Richard Reid doesn't inspire a lot of awe as a terrorist operative. That's certainly true, but I think that it's a mistake to think of him in the same category, because what's interesting about Richard Reid is that he converted to Islam and became a believer in this very, very radical version of Islam. And he represents, in that sense, a vanguard. I think that we're going to have an increasingly difficult time of finding out exactly who the terrorists are, because they will come from the ranks of non-Middle Eastern Europeans or Americans. And that is a phenomenon that should deeply concern us, and we will have a hard time defending against.
You are skeptical that there are any real ties between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. Do you think as we threaten to go to war with Iraq and as we put the pressure on Saddam Hussein and as he sees his life as a tyrant drawing to a close, that he may feel desperate enough to take a chance and partner with al-Qaeda, even though he knows they might turn against him, but what's he got to lose?
There is a paradox. Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda aren't natural allies. But in a situation in which his regime is threatened, then all bets are off, and then he might be prepared to do something that otherwise he never would have imagined.
Now that we've made the threat to go to war, even though you're skeptical that we need to do it now, do you think we have to do it? Because we've kind of like stirred up the wasp's nest. So unless we follow through, are we more vulnerable than we were because Saddam Hussein would feel so threatened and desperate?
I don't think we're there quite yet, and I think there's still room to build the international support that will make it an effort that will be viewed as more legitimate by the international community. I don't think that it's we're in a position yet where our credibility is at stake. I think that, as I said, I don't think we're going to get out of this one easily. I think we probably are going to have to confront him militarily sooner rather than later, but I just hope that we get the timeline right and that those who are prepared to wreak real havoc, catastrophic destruction, are not in a position to do so when we go to war.
Daniel Benjamin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure.
Daniel Benjamin is co-author of the new book, The Age of Sacred Terror. He's the former director of counterterrorism for the National Security Council. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. John Lennon was born 62 years ago today. We'll close with one of his recordings. Support for Fresh Air comes from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of More Grandmothers Are Like Snowflakes, No Two Are Alike, a treasury of wit, wisdom, and heartwarming observations by Janet Lanise. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Wiley, publishers of Turning Points, a new book series featuring Jackie Robinson and the integration of baseball by Scott Simon, host of NPR's Weekend Edition. Now at your local BookSense bookseller or wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with investigative journalist Robert Bryce about his new book, Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.